It is Friday, October 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, an organization that campaigns against the use of nuclear weapons wins the Nobel Peace Prize.
We're thrilled that ICANN has been awarded this year's Peace Prize.
Las Vegas officials hunt for more clues in the deadly mass shooting, and a sequel to the film Blade Runner evokes a colder, isolated world. It's all ahead. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICANN, was awarded the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize Friday. Berit Riis-Andersen, chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, announced the reasons for the award.
We live in a world where the risk for nuclear weapons being used is greater than it has been for a long time. Some states are modernizing their nuclear arsenals, and there is a real danger that more countries will try to procure nuclear weapons, as exemplified by North Korea.
John Loritz is program director at the Massachusetts-based organization International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. I asked him for his reaction to this year's prize going to ICANN.
We're thrilled that ICANN has been awarded this year's Peace Prize, but even more so that the Nobel Committee decided to recognize the Ban Treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, as such an important political milestone in our work to try to achieve a world without nuclear weapons.
How does your organization work with ICANN?
Well, IPPNW actually launched ICANN. We started the campaign back in 2007. And since then, it's really blossomed into this global civil society campaign that includes something like 460 organizations in 101 countries and has really become the largest civil society organization trying to work for the elimination of nuclear weapons. So we've continued to work as the lead medical organization in the campaign. But this has really grown far beyond IPPNW over the last several years.
Well, this year's selection comes as President Donald Trump has threatened both Iran and North Korea concerning their nuclear abilities. The fact that this award comes now, this certainly is significant.
It is significant. And the first thing is really the recognition that the risks and the dangers of nuclear war have really increased over the last few years. And now especially with the escalating rhetoric between Trump and North Korea, but also the growing threat between India and Pakistan and their nuclear weapons, the problems that are related to the Middle East that relate to nuclear weapons, that the risks are really much higher than they have been in many years. And I think the Nobel Committee recognized this in giving the award. It's not just that Donald Trump has his finger on the U.S. nuclear launch code, but it's that nine countries still have nuclear weapons and insist on relying upon them for their security. And I think this award of this Nobel Peace Prize is a refutation of that point of view, that all of these countries really need to now focus on getting rid of nuclear weapons because they threaten all of us.
Your organization, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, what special concerns do physicians have in regard to this issue?
Well, what physicians understand is that there can be no medical response to the use of nuclear weapons should we have another Hiroshima or another Nagasaki or even worse, an all-out nuclear war between two or more countries. The International Committee of the Red Cross has also recognized this, as has the World Medical Association and other major international health federations. So this is something that touches doctors and health professionals very closely because we know that there can be no disaster relief response to a nuclear war. The hurricanes and other extreme weather events that we've experienced over the last few months have shown how fragile our disaster relief responses are, even to something like a natural disaster. In the event of a nuclear war, that kind of response would be just absolutely impossible.
John Loritz, Program Director at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, a story that is perhaps related to the story that we just heard about, but no one's really sure. Yesterday, President Trump at the White House was having a dinner with military leaders and their spouses, and he said that that dinner was the calm before the storm, but didn't elaborate on what that meant. So this has captured social media attention, some people saying that it's the calm before the storm war with North Korea or Iran, calm before the storm, there's a hurricane that's set to hit in the U.S. Over the weekend. Some are wondering if it's kind of a metaphorical storm, like a push for the tax plan on Capitol Hill that was released last week. And then many others are wondering if this calm before the storm is referring to a shakeup in the Trump administration cabinet. Many on social media speculating that President Trump could fire Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who reportedly called Trump a moron and has had reportedly a contentious relationship with the president. Some have even used the hashtag Rexit. Describe Rex Tillerson's potential exit. But no clues from the president as to what this calm before the storm is, getting a lot of attention and speculation. But he says we will find out soon. And I'm sure when we do, that will become a trending topic on social media.
I'm sure it will be. Now, I understand you've been doing some traveling recently.
Yes, I was down in the U.S. state of Florida the past couple days at the Grace Hopper celebration, which is named in honor of Grace Hopper, a pioneer in computer science, female, and Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy, so veteran as well. And it's an event held by the Anita Borg Institute, which is named after another pioneering computer scientist and advocates for computer science for women. And Voice of America was down there in partnership with the Anita Borg Institute holding a town hall about the gaps that women continue to face in technological fields as far as access to technology, as far as improving opportunities for women to advance in tech fields. So we had a great panel discussion with representatives from Google and Intel, a number of women who are doing great things around the world to try to improve access in their communities. And it was something that was great because we got so much input and activity and viewers from around the world on social media, hundreds of people submitting questions on social media that we were able to answer during this town hall event. So it was a very nice opportunity to try to shine some light on the great work that these women are doing and talk about the gaps that still remain. Mm-hmm. One of the things we talked about, even in the U.S., which is seen as kind of a beacon of freedom and equality, there are still many gaps in Silicon Valley as far as a lack of women in leadership positions in tech companies. So certainly companies like Google and a lot of the social and digital media companies are trying to change that. And certainly groups like the Anita Borg Institute are trying to change it as well.
All right. Very interesting. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The U.S. unemployment rate drops slightly, but the economy sheds some jobs. U.S. lawmakers urge full media and aid access to Myanmar. President Trump is set to decertify but not scrap the Iran nuclear deal. And Tropical Storm Nate kills at least 20 people in Central America as it tracks towards the United States. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
How would you like to have your name sent to Mars aboard a NASA spacecraft? The space agency says it's adding a second microchip filled with the names of people who submit them to its InSight spacecraft to Mars. The mission was originally scheduled to take off in March of 2016, but technical issues forced NASA to scrub the launch until May 2018. The first chip made for the original launch date contains over 800,000 names. The InSight mission will be NASA's first mission that will be devoted to exploring the interior structure of Mars. You can submit your name through November 1st at mars.nasa.gov/insight. That's mars.nasa.gov/insight. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about a new version of the film Blade Runner. Police continue to search for clues in the deadly Las Vegas shooting. Gunman Stephen Paddock launched the attack from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel Casino. Police have questioned his girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, who says she didn't know anything about the attack. Paddock had no criminal record, but his late father, Benjamin, was a bank robber and at one time was on the Federal Bureau of Investigation's 10 Most Wanted list. I spoke with Bobby Chacon, a retired FBI special agent. He tells me where he thinks the investigation now stands.
I think it's twofold. I think that the main thrust of the investigation at this point is the why. Because an investigation, you have a who, what, where, when, why, and how, right? So we know what happened. We know where it happened. We know how it happened, mainly. They're still working a little bit on the how, and not so necessarily how he carried it out, but how he amassed the tools to carry it out. So there's a little bit more work to be done on the how of it. But the main question, and what we have the least information on right now, is the why. And while motive a lot of times isn't necessary to prosecute somebody for a crime, it's often vital to figure out who did the crime and why they did it and how to prevent it in the future. So in this case, really, there's a real hunger for why this happened. Now, of course, in many of these incidents, these mass shooting incidents, it's obviously carried out by a clearly deranged individual with mental health issues. So getting down to the why is going to be, you know, somewhat of a frustrating endeavor in the long run, because we're never going to fully figure out why a deranged person carries out a horrendous act to our own satisfaction, because we're reasonable thinking people. The live-in girlfriend coming back from the Philippines, that probably gave them a lot more information. They've already combed over his electronic footprint. Of course, he's an older gentleman. Probably he's older than me, and I feel like I'm behind the curve on the internet and the social media stuff. So, you know, normally when one of these things is carried out, it's carried out by a younger person and they have a bigger social media footprint. They're talking to friends, they're talking to neighbors, they're talking to people who he used to play poker with on a regular basis. In this case, the family members seem a little bit distant from some of the public reporting that I've seen. So the family members might not yield as much information as they normally would in some circumstances, simply because the geographic distance between the family and it looks like his relationship with his brother may have been strained a little bit.
Yeah, it seems like his girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, would be a key figure in all this. But of course, she was in the Philippines. And at least from what we know, she has told the FBI she didn't know anything about this.
That's correct. And normally, again, in this situation breaks a lot of the normal things that we see. Normally, that's the kind of person that would yield the biggest information. Now, you know, they had, you know, somewhat of a different relationship. Every relationship is different, obviously, but they had somewhat of an unorthodox relationship. And being a professional gambler, you know, I've known a few. They live a little different lifestyle than most of us. They're somewhat transient. They move around a little bit. They don't put down roots. And you know, he had previous relationships, two or three marriages, so had she. So I think this was a relationship that was different than most of us would think. And so maybe they didn't share as much information. Maybe they weren't as close. Maybe they spent some time apart from each other more than what we would think is quote-unquote normal couples do.
Now, also, Las Vegas police suggested that at least one of them was saying that he thinks that Paddock couldn't have done this all by himself, that he had to have some assistance. What do you think about that?
I think that's a natural inclination to think that way, but I would not say he could not have. I would, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he had help. However, I would also not be surprised if he did this all on his own. Now, because, you know, I know physically it's hard to wrap around minds around how he could have done this, but it is possible. And people that are deranged to this extent, that will go to this level of planning and make this, you know, the focus of their life, it's not hard for me to think that he could have done it on his own. It also wouldn't be surprised me if he had help.
What about the fact that Paddock was 64 years old? It seems strange that someone would commit such a violent act at that stage of their life and with no, you know, previous record, as far as we know, of violence.
Yeah, this is the big mystery. I mean, there's no domestic violence in his past. There's no other violence in his past. There's no arrest record. There's no, you know, which leads me to believe that there was some kind of simmering rage in him for a long time. Now, whether that, you know, some people are saying it could be a psychopathic gene that he had from his father. And while he didn't have a relationship with his father, you know, certainly that, you know, there's some theories that could be passed down genetically. It's really that's another mystery in this case, that he had no prior background in any of this. He wasn't, even by his brother's own admission, he wasn't a gun guy, so to speak. He wasn't at the gun range and out, you know, firing his weapons all the time. So, you know, it's really a mystery.
Retired FBI Special Agent Bobby Chacon speaking from Los Angeles. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. In 1982's iconic Blade Runner, filmmaker Ridley Scott imagined the dystopian world of 2019 as overcrowded, polluted, and inhabited not only by humans, but by their genetically engineered lookalikes, a disposable workforce called replicants. Almost at the doorstep of 2019, filmmaker Denis Villeneuve creates Blade Runner 2049, a sequel to the original. As the lines between humanity and artificial intelligence are blurred once again, both films probe the nature of life and its moral implications. VOA's Penelope Pulu looks at what sets Denis Villeneuve's ambitious sci-fi sequel apart from Ridley Scott's classic.
Every leap of civilization was built off the back of slaves. Replicants are the future. But I can only make so many.
30 years after violently putting down a revolt by bioengineered near humans called replicants, they've been redesigned to obey unconditionally. However, in Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049, replicants are again surprising their creators. Lieutenant Joshi of the Los Angeles Police sends Blade Runner K to deal with the problem.
There is an order to things.
That's what we do here. We keep order.
The world is built on a wall that separates kind. Tell either side there's no wall. You bought a war.
Josh's words resonate with today's political realities, where walls and fences built across the planet aim to restrict the flow of humanity, dividing the privileged from the undesired. Robin Wright plays Joshi.
It's a story about trying to seek your identity in this near future world. What does it mean to be human anymore? And trying to maintain love and connection as we know it today.
Ryan Gosling interprets Blade Runner K, a police officer and replicant himself, programmed to exterminate his own kind. Along the way, he comes face to face with his own humanity.
When you meet the character, he's sort of at odds with his station in life, and he is looking for some kind of connection and, love and happiness and all of that in amongst this sort of nightmare that they're all living in.
I had your job once. I was good at it.
Harrison Ford reprises his original Blade Runner character as Officer Rick Deckard, who teams up with Kay on his mission. The storyline of Blade Runner 2049 cannot match the original.
We were being hunted.
By who?
But Roger Deakins' cinematic precision on large empty landscapes and muted colors, and Hans Zimmer's unnerving music evoke loneliness in an avant-garde sequel.
The challenges with the environment have progressed to the point where they are life and death issues. And science has loosened its moral constraints.
Denis Villeneuve anchored his idea in the original Blade Runner, but finds his own vision reflecting our social and political anxieties 30 years later. Penelope Kulu, VOA News, Washington.
Happy birthday.
Thanks very much for that, Penelope. In other news, the World Health Organization is sending 900,000 doses of cholera vaccine to Bangladesh to help prevent a major outbreak of cholera in the crowded Rohingya refugee camp that sits on the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar. At least 500,000 Rohingya, a Muslim minority in Myanmar, are crossing the border to escape a military crackdown in their villages. In Yemen, a massive and deadly cholera epidemic has affected almost 800,000 people, and the World Health Organization expects that number to climb to 1 million by year's end. And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has ordered 15 Cuban officials to leave the Cuban embassy in Washington. The move came just days after the United States announced it would significantly reduce its embassy staff in Havana, leaving only emergency personnel to carry out core diplomatic and consular functions. As a result, the United States issued a travel warning for U.S. citizens not to travel to Cuba. The U.S. actions were in response to mysterious attacks, which targeted numerous U.S. embassy employees over a 10-month period. The attacks began last year and continued into August. 22 persons have been medically confirmed to have experienced physical harm from the attacks. Their symptoms include hearing loss, dizziness, balance problems, headache, fatigue, cognitive issues, and difficulty sleeping. The Cuban government has denied any involvement. It has been investigating the attacks and has been cooperating with the United States in its own investigation. Both investigations continue. However, the source, methods, and means of the attacks remain unknown. The United States decided to draw down the U.S. embassy personnel in Havana to limit the number of diplomats who could be exposed to harm. Referring to the expulsion of the Cuban officials from the United States, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said in a press statement, "The decision was made due to Cuba's failure to take appropriate steps to protect our diplomats in accordance with its obligations under the Vienna Convention." In addition, he said, this order will ensure equity in our respective diplomatic operations. But the safety, well-being, and security of its diplomatic personnel are the most important considerations of the U.S. government. Until the government of Cuba can assure that it can and will protect our diplomats, as it is required to do under the Vienna Convention, U.S. non-emergency embassy personnel will not return to Havana.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.